right. Thank you, Stephen. We are glad to have you all here today. And we are going to continue our study in the book of Ecclesiastes, or as it might be translated, the preacher. And the point of this book is Solomon really sharing the wisdom of what he's learned in his life. It's pretty obvious he wrote this toward the end of his life because of all the things he talked about and all the things he's seen. And every one of these chapters takes on a little bit different focus. And chapter 5, where we're at today, talks about wealth, and a large part of it talks about the vanity, the emptiness of just living for gain, basically, and for profit. But we're going to go ahead and read the chapter, and then we will dive back in. Walk prudently when you go to the house of God, and draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they do evil. Do not be rash with your mouth, and let not your heart utter anything hastily before God, for God is in heaven and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. For a dream comes through much activity, and a fool's voice is known by his many words. When you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay. Do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, nor say to the messenger of God that it was an error. Why should God be angry at your excuse and destroy the work of your hands? For in the multitude of dreams and many words, there is also vanity, but fear God. If you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in a province, do not marvel at the matter, for high official watches over high official, and higher officials are over them. Moreover, the profit of the land is for all. Even the king is served from the field. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. There is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun, riches kept for their owner to his hurt. But those riches perish through misfortune. When he begets a son, there is nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, naked shall he return, to go as he came, and he shall take nothing from his labor, which he may carry away in his hand. This also is a severe evil. Just exactly as he came, so shall he go. And what profit is he who labored for the wind? All his days he also eats in darkness, and he has much sorrow and sickness and anger. Here is what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life, which God gives him, for it is his heritage. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. So we have a couple of major themes here. We have the first section is really talking about our tongue and especially about making vows. And the second is talking about riches and wealth and its impact on your life. Back in verse 1, he says, walk prudently when you go to the house of God. Draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they do evil. Prudently means wisely or thoughtfully or respectfully. So it says, when you go to the house of God, you better be going with your eyes wide open and your mind wide open. You better be able to go there for what it's for and respect God when you come before him. And notice what it says, draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools. Now you might say, well, what's the sacrifice of fools? But he's using it here as a contrast. And so some of it, I think, comes just from the fact that he contrasts this. Notice, draw near to hear rather than what? Speak, right? He's talking about the difference. Have you ever noticed, and I talk a lot, and so this is always kind of pointing at me. But have you ever noticed that people really are very different in conversation based on the percentage of time they're talking versus listening? You know, if someone's talking 90% of the time, are they listening very much? They can't. So it's something to think about here, that here it's not just talking about how we talk with each other. It's talking about going to the house of God. He says, if you're wise, you're going to listen. You're going to learn and not to be spouting all the time. The sacrifice of fools here, it says, for they do not know that they do evil. This could mean a sacrifice, like bringing a sacrifice to the temple and doing it with an irreverent attitude, like, well, yeah, I got to bring my sacrifice, but, you know, I'm just over here getting it done and not thinking about what you're doing. Or it could mean basically that they're, and there's a lot of discussion here later that kind of hints at this, that they're being rash in their many words, and they're making vows and things that they don't really mean, and, you know, they're just basically talking it up for show. Verse 2, do not be rash with your mouth, and do not let your heart utter anything hastily before God. For God is in heaven and you on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. Man, that last part, therefore, let your words be few. I think that's some great wisdom. You know, Solomon, of course, wrote Proverbs, and Proverbs is full of statements like this. But you just think about it. God is in heaven, and you're on earth. You're this tiny little speck in a little bitty planet, in a little bitty galaxy, in a tiny little corner of the great universe that God created. Should you be talking or should you be listening? You know, it really speaks to the fundamental relationship between God and man, that he's God and we are not. And we need to listen, and we need to be careful about what we say. And here when it talks about vows, it's talking about, just like we would use the term, making a promise before God. Do not let your heart utter anything hastily. Don't make a rash vow. Notice verse 3. For a dream comes through much activity, and a fool's voice is known by his many words. There again, you have that notion of the fool who's spending more time talking than thinking. But this first part, for a dream comes through much activity, that might be a little confusing in our modern language, because you might think, well, you know, dreams aren't bad, you know. Or maybe he's talking about a dream like something I want to accomplish in my life. This is my dream to accomplish this before I die, or something like that. Well, part of it has to do with understanding the words and how the translation works. So the Hebrew word here for dream is just the word for dream. It doesn't mean anything specifically, good dream, bad dream. It's the same word when it says when a prophet dreams a dream, you know, in other words, sees a vision from God. You know, he says, I'm going to speak to my prophets in dreams. It's the same word. So there's no real distinction in the word, but the rest of the sentence, or the rest of the phrase, for a dream comes through much activity. In the King James, this was written, for a dream comes through much business. And a lot of translations, English translations, will sometimes say, for nightmares come through much worry or much concern. And the context here, what he's talking about is that somebody who's worrying about their day and worrying about their business and everything else is going to have a hard time having restful sleep. You know, I've had dreams before that were fine, that were very nice. You know, I dreamed Jesus came back once. You know, I had a great dream. But most of my dreams are restless and stressful. And, you know, if you've ever had a stressful dream, you ever got tangled up in the sheets, you know, and you're having this dream, you don't know you're tangled up in the sheets, but, you know, you feel like you're in danger and you can't move, you got to go do something, or you're choking and you can't breathe, and you wake up and you're all tangled up in the sheets. You know, I think this is more what he's talking about, is this kind of stressful, restless dream versus sweet sleep and rest. And we'll see a little of this later in the chapter. He talks about the rest of a man getting sweet sleep and being able to rest. And so I really think it's probably talking about that. But notice the contrast. A dream comes through much activity. So if we wanted to translate that probably more like what I'm thinking here, it's like restless sleep comes because of much worrying. And a fool's voice is known by his many words. So you have much activity and many words. And then you have this restless dream and a fool's voice as the analogy being drawn here. And, you know, Solomon said a lot about fools. I mean, we could read probably half of the book of Proverbs is talking about fools. And Solomon's kind of pulling on that a little bit here. He says, you know, if you know some, if someone's a fool, can you tell pretty quick by their talking? You usually can. First of all, there's lots of it. They talk about things they really don't have any business talking about, or they don't have any real understanding about, or they're boasting and making great claims about something that you know for sure they don't really do. You know, it's pretty obvious. You can tell a fool by his many words. Verse 4. When you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have owed, vowed. It is better to vow, not to vow, than to vow and not pay. You know, when somebody would make a vow to God, you think about what you're doing. You're saying, God, I am promising you that I'm going to do this, whatever it is, to the creator of the universe. You think maybe he takes those things seriously? We have a great example of this in the New Testament with Ananias and Sapphira, right? Because in the first part of the book of Acts, it says that Barnabas and some other folks gave lots, you know, they sold lots of land and gave it to the poor saints. And Ananias and Sapphira also sold some land and brought it to the apostles. And Ananias brought it to the apostles, and Peter said, so Ananias, did you sell the land for this much? And Ananias says, oh yeah, I sold it for this much. You know, what was he doing? He was basically saying, I'm giving to God everything that I sold this for. He was lying. And that's what Peter said. He said, why is Satan tempted you to lie? The Holy Spirit. And he fell down dead. And then Sapphira comes in later and does the same thing. And this is an example of how seriously God takes the promises we make before God. Now, here they're talking about vows made at the tabernacle or the temple. In this time period, it would have been the temple. So I'm going to promise you, God, that, you know, when my crops come in, I'm going to bring you an extra 10%. You know, I'm going to make a vow like that. You better do it. You better do it. He has no pleasure in fools. You know, we use that. You'll hear people say that about themselves. I take no pleasure in fools. You know, God's the one who takes no pleasure in fools. And with everything Solomon says about fools, you don't want to be a fool on Judgment Day. That's for sure. But he says here, it's better not to vow than to vow and not pay. It's better to not make a rash promise, to say something that you're really not gonna carry out. He continues in verse 6, do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, nor say before the messenger of God that it was an error. Why should God be angry at your excuse and destroy the work of your hands? For in the multitude of dreams and many words, there is also vanity, but fear God. Now, the messenger of God that is talking about here, this is very likely the situation. If you made a vow, often the priest would come and say, okay, it's time to collect. You said you were going to give this by this time, and I've come to get it. I say, oh, I didn't mean it. It was an error. That's the kind of situation he's talking about here. Or, you know, he comes to the temple and the priest says, hey, Sam, weren't you supposed to bring me an extra two lambs this time? You made that vow last time. And he says, oh, I didn't mean it. Right? This is the vow of a fool to do this kind of thing. He says, let your mouth cause your flesh to sin. Is it sinful for us to make a vow and not carry it out? Yeah, it is. So what about vows that we do today? What about our marriage vows? You think God takes those seriously? You know, it's just as serious, and in marriage, it's even more serious because of the precious nature of the relationship before God. There's a verse in Proverbs that's relevant to this where it says, do not say before the messenger of God that it was an error. Proverbs 20:26. Like a man who throws firebrands, arrows, and death is the man who deceives his neighbor and says, I was only joking. Now, does that mean we should never tell a joke? No, it doesn't mean that. But yeah, go ahead. Oh, sure, it's Proverbs 26, 18 and 19. Okay, like a madman who throws firebrands, arrows, and death is the man who deceives his neighbor and says, I was only joking. But like I said, this isn't about, do you never tell a joke? What he's talking about is somebody who lies. It's deceiving his neighbor. He says, I'm going to do this. No, I was just joking. Does God care about lies? Is that important to God? How might we know that it's important? Well, one thing for sure, one of the Ten Commandments says what? Thou shalt not lie. And if you look at the end of the Bible, you know, if you look at the end of the Bible, at the Great White Throne Judgment scene, you know what it says? It says a bunch of sins, and it says, nobody who is a liar shall enter the kingdom of heaven. Is that important to God? Well, it sure is. We have to be so careful. We have to be so careful in what we say and what we speak. You know, James talks about this. We could have a whole study just on James' discussion of the tongue, that it was an unruly evil full of deadly poison. Who can tame it? Who can control it? Right? And it talks about some of the same things. For saying things, you know, we bless God and we curse men, you know, out of the same mouth. You know, he says these things should not be. Now, the one thing that I wanted to reference here, too, of course, we had that verse up in 3 that said, for a dream comes through much activity. It was talking about, you know, restless sleep because of lots of worrying. If you look at verse 7, it kind of repeats this a little bit. For in the multitude of dreams and many words, there is also vanity. In other words, lots of thoughts mixed up in your head, not being able to rest. Restless troubles and worries would be my best understanding of that. Stephen, you have any other perspective on that? Because it is one of those kind of fuzzy translational issues.
What verse are you talking about? Which part?
Verse 7. Yeah, verse 7 and verse 3, when it talks about the multitude of dreams and all that.
Well, when I was going through, so I did teach on Ecclesiastes several years ago with teenagers, and the only thing that I could come up with possibly was, what are you doing when you're dreaming? Well, you're sleeping. And so if that's the case, then are you dreaming? Are you sleeping too much? Is there a certain aspect of laziness involved here? Which sometimes you dream up, and it's in the context of your speech and what you talk, what you say. And so, the whole idea that I get here from this section is the idea of, what's the phrase? Don't write a check that you can't cash.
That you can't cash, right.
and so that's the idea that I see here from this, especially verse 6. And so you might, yeah, perhaps you're dreaming of something to that end. Again, I'm not entirely sure.
It's a little fuzzy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little fuzzy. I mean, one thing for sure, either of those lessons is good advice, right? Whether it's like don't focus on your worries so much that you never get any sleep, or you know, if you're dreaming, if you're basically spending all your time dreaming and not doing what you should be doing, and, you know, sleeping too much and whatever, the Bible sure talks about the sluggard, right? Solomon in Proverbs talks about the sluggard and says the one who is so lazy won't even lift his hand to feed himself, right? But that's definitely not a wise behavior. That's true. Okay. Well, let's move on to... But the important thing in here is about not making rash vows, and be careful when you promise to God that you fulfill your promise. And there's nothing God hates much worse than a liar. And that's what you're doing when you say you're going to do something when you have no intention of doing it. It's just a lie. All right, verse 8, kind of shifting gears a little bit. If you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in a province, do not marvel at the matter. For high official watches over high official, and higher officials are over them. Now, this is one of those things that you, first of all, that word marvel says do not marvel. You know, when we think about marveling about something, that's usually a positive amazement. you know, in the way we use the language, that's not how it's used in the Hebrew. It basically means to be astonished. In fact, the first definition is consternation, right? So it's kind of a disturbing amazement. It's not something that says, "Wow, isn't that cool?" You know, it's like, "Oh man, what's that?" You know, it's something like that. And you might even say indignation. You know, if you can't read this verse and read some of today's headlines into it or yesterday's, you know, you're probably not reading, but listen to it. If you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in a province, do not marvel at the matter, for high official watches over high official, and higher officials are over them. So first of all, the subject of the sentence is oppression and violent perversion of justice. Does that happen in the world today? Yep, sure does. Now, who's writing this? Solomon's writing it. He was king. So he's at the top of the food chain as far as high officials. What's he saying? If you see this happening in a place, in a province, do not be amazed or marvel or... I get the notion of upset in this. I mean, obviously you're upset if there's oppression going on, right? Or violence going on. And he even says that. Remember earlier in Ecclesiastes, he said... You know, I look for justice and wickedness was there, right? He says there is wickedness in the world. He said that's one of the big frustrations, and it's because of free will. But here, notice the answer to the issue that he says. For high official watches over high official, and higher officials are over them. In other words, somebody is responsible for that situation, and they will be called to account. Because that's that whole notion of higher officials over higher officials. They're going to be called to account. So whatever happens... it's going to be accounted for, even if that means it has to wait to the highest official, to the court of Almighty God at Judgment Day. You know, God is watching too. He's the highest official over all of it, which means that, you know, what was going on in the New Testament in Paul and Peter's time? You had the Emperor Nero doing all kinds of wicked things. And yet, Paul was telling him to pray for the leader, even though there was wickedness. Now, was Paul absolving Nero of all his evil? Of course not. But he's saying God put him there, and we're supposed to pray for our leaders. And so he said we should do that. But was Paul also sure of that God was going to be righteous and just, and that Nero was going to get his just deserts at the judgment? Yep, for sure. So this is just an interesting little bit that says, you know, God's watching. God's going to take care of these things. Does that mean we should never do anything when we see injustice? No, of course not. We should stand up and help things when we can. But does it mean that every injustice in the world we need to be preoccupied with it? Probably not either, because notice what he says. Do not marvel at it. There are officials who are responsible, and they will be held accountable. You know, so it's a bit of wisdom for us to consider. Verse 9 seems a little bit out of place in all this discussion because he says, moreover, so it's connected to the previous thing. He says, you know, there's a problem in a province, right? Oppression or perversion of justice, perversion of righteousness. There are higher officials over them, but he says, moreover, the profit of the land is for all, even the king is served from the field. And the thing that I can get from this obviously, it's, you know, it's kind of true in the sense that, you know, the king may live in the palace, but he still eats the bread that's grown by the farmer out of the dirt, right? So that everything's connected is one of the lessons you learn here. And that you can't, you know, everyone is also impacted by what happens. You know, what happens in the field turns up on the king's table one way or the other, right? So the things are connected, the officials are watching over it, and if something bad happens, it's not going to go unnoticed. Now, in verse 10, he really starts shifting gears towards the notion of focusing on riches. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This is also vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. So what profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? You know, what did Solomon say in the beginning? I tried everything. I tried. I had all kinds of wives. I had riches. I did great projects. I did all kinds of stuff. I had singers. I had possessions. I was wealthier than anybody before me. I tried everything, and it was all meaningless. It was all vain and empty. And here he says, notice the person who focuses on wanting to get wealthy. They're never satisfied. No matter how much they get, they're never satisfied. And so that's a terrible thing when he sees that. He says, because why? He says, your goods increase, but guess what? So do the people who eat them. You know, it's like, you know, a millionaire still has to spend a lot of money for people to take care of his stuff and his money, right? It's that way. And he says, what profit does the owner have except to see them with their eyes? It's going to vanish. That's what he talks about here in a couple of verses. He talks about, hey, it's all going to vanish and you're dead. You can't take it with you. You're going to be naked when you leave this world. You know, so there's that whole connection of the vanity of seeking after wealth, that it's not going to be a way for you to be satisfied with life. And he takes a little bit different angle on that here in verse 12. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much. But the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. Wow. So here he's talking about, you know, a laborer, okay? So this is not a rich man. It's a laboring man, a man who goes out and works hard all day long. And it says, whether he eats a little or much, even if he goes to bed hungry, he can have sweet sleep. But the abundance of a rich man will not permit him to sleep. In other words, he's so worried about his business and his money and his wealth and everything that he can't rest. And they just, you know, this is that same kind of reference to like the workaholic that we've talked about in prior lessons. They're so focused on that that nothing else gives them any peace. There's really two kinds of rich people being talked about here. And this is really the first one. The one who's focused on their self and they're focused on material gain. It says in verse 13, this is a severe evil which I have seen under the sun. Riches kept for their owner to his hurt. You know, this is like the situation that Jesus talked about with the man who had the barns full of food and he had great crops come in and he says, man, I don't have any more room for my food that I've got. I know what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones so I can fill it up more. And then I can just sit back and take it easy and just eat, spend it all on myself. And it says, that night, God said to him, fool, this night your life will be required of you, and who will get all the stuff you've saved up? You know, gain in material possessions and wealth is not going to satisfy. And at the end of the day, you can't take it with you. That's exactly what this is saying. So, you know, you got to figure out what is important and what you are going to focus on. Verse 14, but those riches, the riches kept by the owner to their own hurt, perish through misfortune, and then when he begets a son, there is nothing in his hand. And as he came from his mother's womb, naked shall he return to go as he came, and he shall take nothing from his hands, which he may carry away in his hand. And this is also a severe evil. Just exactly as he came, so shall he go. And what profit is he who has labored for the wind? You see, again, it comes back to that original premise that we saw in early verses of chapter 1. What profit is there when it's all said and done, when your life is over? What have you gained? You haven't gained any wealth because you can't take it with you. You haven't gained any of those other things that he focused on because you're going to leave them behind. So what have you labored for but the wind, if that's all you focused on? Verse 17, all his days he also eats in darkness, and he has much sorrow and sickness and anger. He's talking about this person that's so focused on wealth and riches that all they can do is a miserable life. I mean, look at that. Eats in darkness and has much sorrow and sickness and anger. That does not sound like a happy life. He might be the wealthiest man in the world, but he's not happy. And so here's where you start seeing the contrast of the wealth of the wealthy person who is blessed by God. Verse 18 and 19, the last two verses of the chapter. Here is what I have seen. So he's kind of summarizing here. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all of his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life, which God gives him, for it is his heritage. But let's just stop there a second. Now, Solomon said this a couple of times already, and it's one of his themes that he repeats. What is good for you to do in your life, during the days of your life, is to work hard and enjoy the fruit of your labor. He said, that's a good thing. And if God blesses you with that, that's a great blessing. Notice verse 19, though. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him the power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is a gift of God. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. Now, you might have been a little surprised by that because he's been kind of beating on the rich man up here, right? He's been saying the rich man, you know, the rich man who only cares about riches, he's never satisfied. He has a miserable life. He's going to perish. He's going to be naked when he dies. He's not going to have anything to give to anybody. It sounds like a pretty miserable go. And then all of a sudden here in verse 19, he says, and for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth. So, well, okay, it's a rich man. But notice the difference. And given him power to eat of it. In other words, to enjoy it. And he says, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. That's a big difference. There's really two kinds of rich people that are talked about here. There's the selfish materialist who just wants more and more and more. And there's what I termed here the godly giver, who decides to live for God. God's blessing him. He's wealthy. But he's not stuck on his wealth. He's happy that he has it. He enjoys it. And he uses it for good. That's the kind of stuff that you can rejoice in. It's one of the things you see about rich, you know, people who are materialists, someone who's focused on just money, is, you know, what are they happy about? They're happy that they're richer than everybody, I guess. You know, that's probably about all you can say, that they can buy anything they want. You know, how many times have you heard songs that says money can't buy you love, you know, let alone the Beatles? You know, it's not going to buy you happiness. But here he says there's a rich man who is happy, who is blessed by God and given that blessing as a gift from God to be happy with the wealth he has. And notice what it talks about. Remember, we've had all this discussion about the workaholic that can't even sleep at night, can't rest because of all of his restless dreams. Notice verse 20. For he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life. In other words, he's not going to worry. Because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. You ever heard the saying that if you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life? You know, because basically you love your work. You know, this is kind of what he's talking about. That if God blesses you with the ability to earn a living and love what you do, that is a blessing from God. And notice, he says, God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. He's not going to sit around and fret all night. And guess what? His sleep's going to be sweet because he's not worried. So what do we learn from all that? First of all, one thing for sure, you know, he's not saying that anyone who's wealthy is evil or is going to be miserable. There's lots of examples of wealthy people in the Bible who were very blessed by God. You know, Job was one. Abraham was another. You can see lots and lots of the leaders, Solomon, of course, David, who were very wealthy and were blessed by God and were able to live a blessed life like Abraham or Job. We're not, you know, it's not wrong to have those things. It's wrong to do what? Notice what he said. To keep them and hoard them up to your own hurt. Riches kept for their owner to his hurt. And to love riches is a source of that trouble. Loving silver, loving abundance. I want more and more and more. That's what I love, is having more and more. You're never going to be happy. But here, somebody whose God has given blessings to and is made wealthy, God also gives him the power to enjoy it and rejoice in it. That's a great blessing from God. And, you know, we've talked about it a little before. This is kind of the end of the chapter, so I'm going to just make one little statement here, and we're going to stop. Are you rich? Has God blessed you? Where do you fit in this? Where do you fit on this spectrum? For every man whose God has given riches and wealth, you know, first of all, riches and wealth are relative things. And that doesn't always mean money. But how many of you would say that you're really rich, that you're really wealthy? Well, in American culture and American economy, you might not be. But I guarantee you, every single person who hears me on this call is wealthier than probably 80 to 90% of everybody who lives in Honduras or in Chad or in India. I've been there. Stephen has too. You see people who are literally living in mud huts with no windows, no doors, and barely scrape a living, a survival living, off the land. You know, we were talking about the farmers in Honduras that, because of the economy, the damage to the economy from the coronavirus, didn't have any seed. He said Anael told me that some of them were eating these palm nuts, and we had to go look these up. They're called coyos. And a coyo nut is edible, but it's got like a half-inch thick shell on it that you can only break with a sledgehammer. And then you get this little tiny nut about the size, about 1 to 2 centimeters is all you got. And there were people who were so hungry that they were sitting there beating these things with rocks, trying to break them open to get a little teeny bit to eat. Now, have you ever had to do that? I doubt it. If you have, God bless you. But I tell you what, most of us have probably never had to work that hard for a meal. Maybe sometime in our life we've been poor and we've gone to bed hungry. Maybe we did. But to live that way all the time, to live in a mud hut and be basically starving, you see, we're all incredibly blessed. And we need to keep that in mind. You know, it's easy to say, I don't have the money that Bill Gates has or whatever, you know. And that's true. But we're incredibly blessed. Here in this country, we're blessed with our jobs. We're blessed with the social services that we get in this country. We have incredible, incredible blessings. The question is God giving you joy in what you do? Can you rejoice in your wealth and enjoy it? And remember, the key to rejoicing in your wealth is not to hoard it for yourself, but to give it and make it a blessing to others. So we'll stop there, and we'll pick up in chapter 6 next time.